Chair McAdoo?
Present.
Vice Chair Drajak? Regent Carter?
Here.
Regent Lieberman? Regent Perkins?
Here.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you. All right, we will open for public comment. Is there any public comment here? I don't see any public comment. So we will move to the consent items. And we will need a motion and second for that, please.
Motion to approve.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. All right. And Regent Lieberman has joined us. Thank you, Sam. All right. So item number three, I would like to invite Margot Martin from CSN to the podium, please. Thank you.
Good morning. It is a distinct pleasure to present our new baccalaureate degree in environmental management. This is a degree that is a workforce entry-level technician type of degree. Industry, in fact, approached CSN faculty requesting a technician-level program that would produce highly trained graduates that could hit the ground with minimal on-the-job training. So looking to have scientists who are prepared to pull on their work boots and their dungarees and head out into the field. This program cultivates leadership as well, preparing students to enter the labor force with learned skills that have a direct workforce transfer to their employer. Today, organizations are looking for employees with strong ethics who are skilled not only in their technical field, but also in communication. Our graduates are going to be fully prepared to analyze and manage environmental risks, development, compliance, and regulations at the technician level in today's complex environmental field. Some of the businesses and industry partners that we have had engagement with are Western Technologies, Southwest Geotechnical, the Clark County Water Reclamation District, the City of Henderson Lab, the City of Las Vegas Lab, Terracon, Wright Engineering, and quite a few others. So ultimately, this program also will dovetail with our recently launched AAS degree in environmental management. So not only does it create a pathway to the work world, but it creates that 2-year to 4-year pathway as well. And one final point that my faculty did not offer up, but I'm really proud of, is that this is an area where we do a lot of undergraduate research, and it's an area where we have an opportunity to do even more in that arena. So thank you. Also, I've got Doug Sims. Dr. Sims is our new Dean of Science and Mathematics. He's also the former faculty member who developed both the AAS and the BAS, or led the development of those degrees in environmental management. He's on the phone in case you have some specific science-like questions.
Thank you. Is there any discussion before we entertain a motion for either of you on the phone?
Madam Chair, I have a question about how many students now are in the AA program.
And I would defer to Doug. Doug, if you're on the line, could you share the number of students we have in the current AAS program? I believe we just launched that.
Yeah, we actually just launched that officially 2 weeks ago. And as I'm aware, we have 100 students interested. We have about 20 that have actually registered for that program, which would feed into the BAS, which has a limited entry of only 20 students. Period. There's nothing above that.
Thank you so much. And also as a follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I understand it's the workforce development degree. Are there, will it be available to those employees who are already working in the field to perhaps further their education and go for this BA degree? Or BS, yeah, BAS degree.
Oh, absolutely. This degree is going to be available. So it really is a 2+2. So a student that would enter into this BAS degree would need to meet those first 2-year requirements. But absolutely, you wouldn't necessarily have to complete the AAS degree in environmental management to be able to enter into the BAS degree in environmental management.
Thank you so much. No further questions.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. Are there any other questions? If not, I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
Motion by Regent Lieberman and a second.
Second.
And a second by Regent Carter. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 No opposition. Passes unanimously.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you. That's very exciting. Thank you. All right. And now I would like to invite Vice President Jake Rivera from Great Basin College to the podium, please.
For the record, Jake Rivera, Vice President of Student Academic Affairs at Great Basin College. I'm here to present for the approval of a Bachelor of Science degree program in comprehensive medical imaging, a program that provides Great Basin College students and students across Nevada with a degree that matches their commitment to education. We do not want to lose our prospective students that are currently enrolled in our certificate program, where most other comparable programs do have a bachelor-level program. We expect to prepare bachelor-level students with leadership and technical skills that will translate well into clinical practice, elevating healthcare in our area and rural areas across Nevada. I was asked to keep it short, so...
That wasn't by me, but thank you. All right. Are there any questions on the phone?
Just one quick question, if I may.
Yes, please.
Why BS versus BAS?
One of the things that we've found is that for students who are transferring from other institutions that are looking for a bachelor level program, many of those students are coming from programs that are already Associate of Science degree programs, and so we're just trying to make sure that the pathways are the most convenient and easiest for the student to transfer.
Okay. Are there other questions? If not, I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
All right. Thank you, Regent Lieberman. And a second for that motion?
Second.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I vote aye as
aye.
Well.
Aye.
All right. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, moving on to agenda item number 5, Nevada State College, and I will invite Vicki Shields to present to us. Thank you.
Good morning, Regents. For the record, Vicki Shields, Provost and Executive Vice President at Nevada State College. It's my pleasure today to present the Human Health Sciences Bachelor of Science degree. We have been working very hard at Nevada State College to try to find pathways that are meaningful for those that want to go into nursing in particular and into the health fields. And so right now, the pre-nursing students at Nevada State College number anywhere between 800 and 1,000 students waiting to get into pre-nursing. And our nursing program takes 224 per year. So you can see that's quite a funnel. And although so many of those students, you
if
know,
if you can hear me, our audio just cut out here on the phone.
Okay. Let me start over.
I can hear you. We're checking into that. Thank you for letting us know. One second. Shall we? Can you let us know when you can hear us, Regent Carter? Regent Carter? Regent Perkins? Somebody's going to let me know, right? Okay. So Regent Carter and Regent Perkins, can you hear us? Regent Carter and Regent Perkins.
Okay. The call dropped and they have to dial in again.
So are they dialing in?
Okay.
Oh, thank you. So, do what? Okay. Well, we'll wait to see if the phone works. If it doesn't, we may move to an information-only item,
right,
and then, sorry.
So our challenge is we have an agenda full of action items, so sit tight.
And two committee members in the room.
The mic, right? All right. Did you see me
press down? I did.
Okay. So,
Regent Carter.
Regent Carter and Regent Perkins.
We're trying to download it.
Can you hear us?
Thank you. I was just about to text you back.
They're calling in. Well, we can hear them. Yeah.
We can't. But they couldn't hear us, I guess.
Regent Carter.
Jake, I'm especially glad you kept it short.
I think we're back.
Oh, good. Can you hear us?
Yes.
All right. And are you and Regent Perkins in the same place?
Yes, we're going from
perfect.
The Regent's room here.
Okay, good. All right, then Vicki will continue. Thank
okay.
you for letting us know.
You bet. I'll keep it brief. So the Bachelor of Science in Human Health Sciences is really a new pathway primarily for all of our pre-nursing students that do not get into the nursing program but need a bachelor's degree and want to stay in the health sciences. And also we hope that it will be a very attractive degree on its own right. The reason the original enrollment numbers look a little high is because we do have that population of pre-nursing students there, and so in the first year we can advise them into this track as they begin. So we do know that we're pretty much guaranteed those numbers as if we advise them in. Right now, the pre-nursing students enter into an interdisciplinary studies degree. And so it has the same pre-nursing core. So we've been very careful that those two pathways have the same pre-nursing core. So if those students take that degree and they get through their core and they don't get into the nursing program, they will not miss a credit or a beat to finish up their bachelor's degree if they so choose.
Very good. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Regent Carter.
So when you're advising the students, how do you explain the difference between this degree program and nursing?
Well, they all declare pre-nursing, and so there's this core that they have to take that's pre-nursing courses, physiology and anatomy and different courses that only lead to really a nursing degree in the past. And so they know that they have to take these to even be considered to get into the nursing program. So they're advised very well on that as they begin. But in either one of these options, they'll be in the correct sequence of courses to either get into the nursing program or to be able to finish in one of these degree pathways.
But do you explain what the outcome would be of this degree versus the nursing degree, so what the career opportunities might be?
Absolutely. Yes, they're advised from the very beginning what the opportunities would be here versus the nursing. And there will be a lot of them that just want to be nurses, period, and we know that. That's at all of our institutions, really. But we need to do our best just to provide options. And so we think this is a broad-based, good option. But, yes, they definitely will be advised that it's a very different outcome with this Bachelor of Science than it would be with a nursing degree. Yes.
And I would just say with my experiences in healthcare, I think this degree can provide the student with many avenues. So
yes,
thank you for that.
We certainly hope so.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Okay, I will actually make the motion and I'll look for a second.
Second.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. All right, and now I would like to invite Dr. Chris Hevia from UNLV.
We need to vote.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. We do. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Passes unanimously. Thank you, Regent Carter.
Chris Heavey, Interim Executive Vice President and Provost of UNLV, for the record. Thank you, Chair McAdoo and Regents and Vice Chancellor Abba. I'm here to present our new proposal for a doctoral degree in neuroscience at UNLV, and we're excited to add this to the list of our doctoral offerings. We all know, I think, that neuroscience is one of the fastest growing fields in the country and one of the best opportunities for funded research on issues that are profoundly important to our society, such as degenerative conditions of the brain, etc. It's a type of training that we've actually been offering for quite a few years through our Department of Psychology, through our experimental psychology doctoral program. But our goal now is to create an interdisciplinary program that would weave together the faculty across the university from the College of Liberal Arts, the College of Sciences, the College of Integrated Health Sciences, and the School of Medicine to offer and create the synergies of all of the faculty who work in this very interdisciplinary area. We've worked closely with our partners at University of Nevada, Reno, and consulted with them. They offer a doctoral degree in integrated neuroscience as well, and gotten some great consultation from the director of their program on the formation of this new interdisciplinary doctoral program at UNLV.
Thank you. Are there any questions? All right. I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
Motion to approve.
Thank you. So we will take the vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 I vote aye as well. Motion passes. Thank you. Thank you for your work on that. All right. And now I will invite Provost Kevin Carman from UNR to come forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Del Carlo. McAdoo, I'm sorry. Kevin Carman, Executive Vice President and Provost for the record at the University of Nevada, Reno. I have, I think I'll be up here for three proposals. The first is the Bachelor in Musical Theater. A colleague of mine offered me $5 to sing the proposal, but another one offered me $10 not to, so I'll just read it. So we are proposing a bachelor's degree in musical theater. This will be a highly selective interdisciplinary musical theater major that allows students to rigorously engage in the physical practices of acting, voice, and dance training while simultaneously developing a deep understanding of the historical, cultural, and performance evolution that underpins the field. The students pursuing this major will combine the artistic, cognitive, and somatic skills necessary to enter the field as musical theater practitioners and scholars. In order to balance these skills, musical theater majors will create, analyze, and perform throughout their undergraduate careers. The goal of this program is to lay the foundation for a pre-professional Bachelor of Fine Arts, which we hope to launch in 5 to 7 years. It also is good timing with the facilities that have come online recently, the new arts building, as well as updates to Church Fine Arts. And we feel that this program is consistent with our R1 aspirations and our status as a as an arts and sciences professions balanced university. It is also consistent with an investment that we've made over a longer term. In 2015, we approved a group of faculty hires to develop a Doctor of Musical Arts program at the university. That process is underway. We've added several faculty, and this BFA in musical theater will be a nice complement to the doctoral program that we'll be bringing to you in the near future. I'd also note that TMCC offers an associate's degree in musical theater. I believe that's the only other musical theater in NSHE, but it will provide a nice complement for those students who wish to pursue further studies in musical theater. Happy to entertain questions.
All right. Do we have any questions? Yes, Regent Lieberman.
Will this program include anything about the business side of theater or musical theater or just?
It's focused primarily on performance, but as I understand it, it's intended to be highly interdisciplinary and including business elements as well if students wish to pursue that. It's not an explicit part of the curriculum, but the proposal suggests that it wants it to be highly interdisciplinary, which I would think would include business, and I think that's a great suggestion. And I'll come back to our group, and if that isn't part of it explicitly, encourage them to do that.
I think it needs to be because of the community focus on the business of the arts.
Yep, absolutely.
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent Lieberman. I'll entertain a second. I will second that motion. All those in favor, are there any questions on the phone?
No.
Okay.
Just real quick, I just want to make sure that that they're working with Truckee Meadows Community College as well to see if there's a pathway or some transfer classes for folks that might be in that Associates of Arts Musical Theater there.
Oh, I'm sorry, Regent Carter, maybe Provost Carman actually addressed that. I'm trying now to wonder if you can hear very well on the phone. Do you feel like you're hearing everything we're saying in here? Because he addressed that TMCC's Associate in Musical Arts and how this is a pathway to that.
And so, we do have an articulation agreement with them.
So. And they have that. So did you hear that, the articulation agreement?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions? All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 I vote aye as well. Congratulations. And by the way, I always consider it a compliment when I'm called Regent Del Carlo.
My apologies, and I'm very embarrassed by that.
I'm teasing with you. Thank you.
Shall I move on to
yes.
Next
we'll
item
move to agenda item number 8 for the Master's in Business Analytics.
Thank you, Chair McAdoo. Mm-hmm. Again, Kevin Carman, UNR, for the record. We are proposing two additional degrees, master's degrees, that will be online degrees. I'll add as a comment as a preface that this is part of our ongoing goal of expanding our online degree offerings at the university. We have a variety of them. These two degrees are part of three that will be launching in January. The third that I won't present to you today because we already have it as a traditional degree, as a master in accounting. And all three of these will be done in partnership with Pearson Embanet, and again, all three of them will be offered online, and our goal is to launch all three of these programs in January, and they will add on to the two programs that we currently have with Pearson Embanet, which are social work and community health sciences. So the first, this agenda item 8 is a master's degree in business analytics. It will be operated through the Department of Information Systems and the College of Business. This degree proposes to prepare students to launch a career exploring and analyzing data to identify, understand, and answer questions that are critical to organizations. The degree program integrates knowledge and skills in big data management, quantitative analytical skills, organizational decision-making, and information communication in order to address significant questions. The program is designed to meet growing need for data science professionals, giving graduates the skills to help organize and harness the understanding and understand the power of information. I will mention that UNLV has a master's degree in data analytics and applied economics. That's a face-to-face program. Our program will be an online program. And then they also offer a graduate certificate in data analytics, which we believe is also offered in a face-to-face format. So those are the other two programs that would be comparable within the system. Happy to answer any questions about this program.
Thank you for that information. Are there any questions?
Regent or Chair McAdoo.
Yes. Please.
So with Pearson, do we pay a percentage of the expense of the program to Pearson, or how does that work?
So these programs, all of the programs that we offer through Pearson are self-supporting programs, so they do not generate weighted student credit hours, for example. So they're all based on the tuition that they generate. Pearson gets a percentage of the total tuition revenue. It varies slightly with different programs. In exchange for that, they do marketing. They work with our faculty to do conversions of courses to an online format. And they also provide technical support and tutoring assistance to students. But yes, Pearson does get a percentage of the total tuition revenue.
Any follow-up questions? All right, I will entertain.
Is Chancellor Riley in there by any chance?
He is not. I don't.
Okay. I was just going to ask him about the online Arizona and how that might be different than the Pearson, but that's good.
Well, I could answer that partially, Regent Carter, that the online program at Arizona State University, they've been at it much longer, of course, than we have, but they originated their program as a partnership with Pearson. And they still have a partnership with Pearson, although it is evolving, and they are doing more of their own marketing and operations now as they grow and mature. But they actually began that very significant online program that they have by partnering with Pearson.
Do you have any follow-up questions, Regent Carter?
No, I'm good. Motion to approve.
All right.
Second.
All right. Second. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 I vote aye as well. Passes unanimously. And we will move to item number 9. Thank you.
Thank you again, Chair McAdoo, Kevin Carman, UNR. For the record, we offer you, for your consideration, a master's degree in cybersecurity. I will note that this master's degree complements nicely the Center for Cybersecurity that you approved a few years ago that is thriving and doing some great things on campus. But it will be offered through the College of Engineering, Department of Computer Science and Engineering, and with significant oversight from our Cybersecurity Center. It will offer an online integrated course of study covering the theory, implementation, and design of secure cyberspace, such as secure communication, computation, information, and cyber physical systems, the Internet of Things, hardware, and embedded systems. The cybersecurity, as I'm sure you know, is one of the most significant economic and national security challenges of the 21st century. However, the U.S. has a significant shortage of cybersecurity professionals who understand and can effectively thwart the growing threats. As a result, cybersecurity training and education has become a national priority. There is a very high demand for cybersecurity professionals in every sector, including industries such as aerospace and defense, banking, healthcare, information technology, advanced manufacturing, and online gaming, all of which are increasingly important components of Nevada's economy. This program will make it possible to educate future leaders in this emerging area. And again, I'll note that there's no other cybersecurity program, degree program being offered within NSHE now, although, again, I'll note that UNLV does offer a certificate in cybersecurity, which is, again, taught in a face-to-face format.
Regent Lieberman.
Do we have any idea, because this is such a relevant topic now, the numbers of people that are interested in applying or anything along those lines?
I've actually forgotten what the proposal projects in terms of numbers of students, but I can tell you that our fastest growing undergraduate program at UNR is in computer science and engineering. Mm-hmm. I think that there's an immense interest in this area, so I expect it to be heavily subscribed.
Motion to approve.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All right. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 I vote aye as well.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we will move to Assistant Vice Chancellor Renee Davis for agenda item number 10, and she's going to present some highlights for us from the financial aid report. Thank you.
Good morning, Renee Davis, Nevada System of Higher Education, Assistant Vice Chancellor and Director of Student Affairs. And I'm here today to report on the 2017-18 NSHE financial aid. As a former financial aid administrator, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. But even more importantly, financial aid is an integral tool for achieving the board's goals. And if I can advance the slide here. Of course, access, success, closing the achievement gap. Financial aid, it plays a big part in reaching all of these strategic goals. And just a few more points on why do we report every year to you on financial aid. I mean, at the very core of financial aid is the philosophy that no student should be denied a college education due to the inability to pay for it. But also, there are some board policy requirements we meet every year by doing this report. And there's, of course, the constantly changing national landscape in the financial aid world. This is, a lot of these slides you'll see are typical every year, so the story changes a little bit, but we try to deliver consistent message so you can compare year to year. And there's many more of these tables and charts within the report itself. So on this first slide, we're showing you the total financial aid disbursements. They peaked to $622.6 million in 2017-18, so that's the highest it's ever been. And you can see it has fluctuated a tad over the last five-year period. And then we also like to break it down by institution because each of the institutions have a little bit of a different story. You can see for 17-18 as compared to the year prior, NSC had the largest increase. And then if you look at the five-year period, then UNR had the largest increase. And you will see a really large decrease of 46% over the five-year period for Western Nevada College, and I'm sure we put a circle on that just to remind me to talk about it a little bit. So why are we seeing that? A big reason for that is the shift in the enrollment to high school students. So high school students don't qualify for federal and most state aid programs, so they wouldn't be, while the enrollment is staying kind of steady or so, you're going to have fewer students who actually qualify for financial aid. In addition, at all of the community colleges, there are efforts to help students borrow conservatively or not at all if they don't need to borrow and kind of hold off on borrowing until later in their college careers. So you'll see a big decrease in loans. And also enrollment changes, and as the economy improves, the reduction in Pell Grant dollars. So all of those things kind of impact that total number that you see. On my next slide, I always like to show this breakdown of where we're at what kind of awards are students getting? And so we break it down into five major categories. In loans is typically the biggest category, but the good news is that the proportionally the percentage of overall aid disbursements comprised by loans is actually on the decrease. So proportionally it's getting a little smaller every year, and hopefully that will continue to decrease. We'll just have to see. And then as far as where did those other percentages get made up, it actually, they all increased a little bit. So, and then we also like to look at what is the source of funding to the financial aid to our students across the system. And as usual, again, federal is always the biggest category. That piece of the pie, too, is decreasing a tad, and it has gone down for the last 3 years. As some of the state aid, the state portion has picked up a little bit as we've seen some new programs come online. And also institutional aid, as the tuition set aside dollars have increased over the years, that also has made a difference. We can't talk about financial aid without talking about the Pell Grant, which is the most recognized and also the largest grant program in the nation. In fact, you see a little tidbit there, trivia tidbit, maybe $28.2 billion in 1 year to students nationwide. So it's a huge program. In 17-18, the maximum award a student could get for two semesters was $5,920, and that's for a student who had the maximum financial need and was attending at least 12 credits per semester. So what we like to show is that not every student obviously gets that maximum award. So this slide shows the average award to NC students, and again, this is system-wide, was $3,585 compared to the national, which was around $4,000. Now, this is impacted not only by the student's level of need, but also the level of enrollment. So with the Pell Grant, you do have a proration based on enrollment level. So it could be a combination of the two factors that is resulting in that lower average. Loans, as I mentioned, proportionally are going down, and so also going down in dollars disbursed. And it hasn't been huge decreases over the last few years, but I think most financial aid directors support loans as a tool for students to fund their education, but of course, less borrowing is always better, and minimal borrowing is always recommended for students. And this slide just breaks down by institution, and you can see that when I mentioned earlier about the loan decreases impacting the overall top number, you can see that this is certainly true at all four of our community colleges. And then only very slight increases at the four-year institutions, mostly probably enrollment related. So at this point, I'm going to shift to specifically the Nevada financial assistance programs. And for this reporting year, we have five programs. You'll all probably notice that one program we don't list there is the Nevada Promise Scholarship, and that one will show up next year when I'm reporting to this committee again, because the first year of awards was 2018-19. So for 17-18, you can see that we had these five programs: Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship, Grants and Aid, Regents Higher Education Opportunity Award, Regents Service Program, and the Silver State Opportunity Grant. And I'll talk about each of these individually. So for Millennium, the story has been going on since the legislature created this program in 1999, and the first students were awarded the high school graduating class of 2000. And this slide, we just like to remind you that the program has changed in many ways since its inception. One of the ways it's changed is the entering GPA or other requirements for initial eligibility. Also, the population of Nevada high school graduates has increased exponentially since 2000. So even though you might look at that bottom number on and see that perhaps fewer students than initially activated their award are doing so, the real number is still going up because we have so many more graduates coming in through the doors. And also, these eligibility numbers were impacted by a change made in 2015 that allowed students to qualify, if not by high school GPA, they can qualify by test scores. So that made a big change, much bigger than I actually was expecting. This second slide on the Millennium Scholarship is one we recently started offering, which just kind of shows where the dollars go, which students at which institutions. And this has been a pretty consistent story over the years where the lion's share, nearly 90% for 17-18, go to the students at the four-year institutions. And this is for two reasons. One, the per credit award is greater at those institutions. It's $80 per credit at UNR and UNLV and $60 per credit at NSC. And then at the community colleges, it's $40 per credit for lower division courses. So that makes a difference, but then also at the four-year institutions, you tend to have more students enrolled in the maximum of 15 credits. So that all feeds into that total. And by the way, the $34 million is also a high. That's a considerable chunk of change, and that was impacted also by the change in 2015 where the legislature moved up the maximum award level from 12 credits to 15. So that made more dollars available to students each semester of enrollment. Nevada Grants and Aid, in contrast, is not a formal state program. It's kind of a patchwork of various programs that happen at the campus level, many of them with a board authorization. You could have an athletic grant and aid, graduate assistant grant and aid, non-resident grant and aid. And while the sources of funding mostly come from the state, there's also a little federal portion and institutional and just a little tiny bit from private. And lots of times those other sources come in for the graduate assistant grants and aid, but it could be a variety of circumstances. The Regents Higher Education Opportunity Award is another varied program. It is authorized in the board policy, and it actually has two portions. So one portion actually is where the institutions set aside money in their state-supported operating budget to be awarded as financial aid. And it can be awarded as grant, scholarships, or work study, and that is a decision made by the campuses. And then there's also the bigger portion and growing portion is that portion of the set-aside from the registration fee. So if you look at the distribution of fees and procedures and guidelines, you'll see there's certain amounts set out for state-supported budget, there's certain amount portioned out for capital improvements, those types of things, and then there's student access. So that student access line is actually what goes to the financial aid office for awarding as financial aid. The Regent Service Program is another program established by this board. It's a very specific program, and it's one where institutions set aside money also within the state-supported operating budget under the scholarship function. And this program is similar to work study, but it has a little different focus. It's targeted to students who have a little higher skill level to give them a little more rigorous job experience. And it also has a unique set of eligibility requirements that are set by the board. So it's a relatively small program, but it is a great program, and I know where it's utilized, it's very much appreciated. The students get really valuable job experience, and the campuses often benefit from some really great employees that way.
May I ask a question here really quickly?
Certainly.
So I'm just curious, and maybe Provost Shields would need to answer it, or you can. I noticed Nevada State has zero students and $0 for that program. So I'm assuming that institutions decide whether they're going to participate. And I'm just curious really why there wouldn't be any students at Nevada State. But
I don't know the answer to the why, but you're correct. It would be at an institution level decision. Okay. And to my knowledge, at least since I've been doing this report, I haven't ever seen awards in this program for Nevada State College. I don't know.
Okay. It's not a put you on the spot question. I'm sorry. I just was curious that
we can find out and give you that information.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So the Silver State Opportunity Grant, as lots of people know, is our fairly new. It was created by the legislature in 2015, and our only state-supported grant, need-based grant program. I have said that so many times, I don't know why I just stumbled over that, but anyway. This program is offered to students at Nevada State College as well as our four community colleges, and it's very much a need-based program, but also has what you might term as merit-based requirements in that the students need to be college-ready. And so we have a kind of a fairly lengthy definition of what it means to be college-ready, but essentially you need to be ready to take your college-level math and English courses at the time you get the award. And this award, by the way, isn't just targeted at entering freshmen. It can be awarded to students at any level. So maybe if they enter a little bit below the college level and they then remediate or do whatever they need to do to get to the next level, then they would still qualify for the SSOG, which is kind of a nice aspect of the program. We always love to look at these numbers, and the SSOG program is the first program, statewide program, where we can look at these numbers for every single student, and that's because the FAFSA is required, and that's how eligibility is determined. So we have income information on all of our SSOG recipients, unlike our other programs, which it's just always it's a portion of the population that gets awarded. So here you can see that we really are targeting the exact students that need the help the most, the low-income students, the median income for dependent students, so that's the whole family, the parents, and the student, and whatever siblings that are part of that family, $34,000. So if you think about that and maybe a family of four, it's pretty darn low. And then if you look at our independent students, who by and large would be 24 and older, and are supporting themselves and possibly a family, $16,000. So that's the median, and you can see that in the ranges as low as $29.99 or less, we had nearly 100 students in 17-18 qualify for SSOG in that category. Yes?
So for the record, I think this should shake every single one of us in this room to our very core. I mean, $16,000 for an independent student, a dependent student, $34,000, if we just look at that. When I reviewed this, I'm just telling you, It was highly emotional for me to realize that. So I'm in my own way, going to be working on trying to figure out some other ways to help these students. Thank you.
And then finally, my last slide, which is just going back to the overview of all financial aid. And in this time, it's a breakdown of recipients by race, ethnicity, and institution. And it's such a busy slide, I don't have room on it to put the institutional levels, minority levels, in as a comparison. But if you take this and go to one of the data dashboards and just look at the overall population at these institutions, you'll see that it reflects it, or in many cases, percentage of students who from underrepresented categories are awarded at a higher rate than they are in the general population. So it's always been a good story, and I have to applaud all of our financial aid offices for making sure that the recipients of financial aid are representative of the populations on those campuses. And that concludes my presentation, unless there are any questions.
Thank you for the presentation. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And Regent Carter and Regent Perkins, I'm just making sure that you can still hear what's going on.
Yes, we can still hear. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. So we're on agenda item number 11 with Vice Chancellor Abbott and Research Scholar Theo Meek. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, while Theo gets organized at the podium. As we conclude the financial aid report, I would like to take a moment of privilege, Madam Chair, and acknowledge Sharon Worm. This is her last board meeting. She's retiring. She's been in the system for over 20 years, I believe. I got to know Sharon when she – 30 years. Oh, my God. Let's all have a moment of silence for Sharon. anyway, seeing her, I realized that this is her last board meeting, and I will personally miss her dearly. So, Sharon. So with that, we will present on the status of the work of the implementation task force for the co-requisite policy that this board adopted at its June board meeting. Just a quick reminder of what that policy was. We worked with Complete College America and a number of other organizations. It's kind of been in the works basically for almost 7 years, and the board ultimately adopted it in June and gave us a 2-year period for implementation. So as we've worked through a lot of the issues related to implementation, we've kind of bifurcated our timeline. So we're going to have 1 year dedicated to essentially the development of the institutional or sector level action plans that will come to this board about this time next year. And then the institutions will have academic year 2021 to essentially implement those plans so that they can be ready for full scale implementation as the board required in fall of 21. So if you'll turn now to the reference material, there's basically three pieces to this. One is kind of a timeline of all the things that — this was my summer break and Theo's. You'll see that we spent a great deal of time working through all the pieces that we have to have in place so that we can hit the ground running with the task force at their first meeting in September. The second item in here is basically a schedule, for lack of a better term, and I'm going to go over that in some detail. And then the last item I wanted to share with you, we are in the process of working with Dr. Heidi Loschbaugh, who presented on this item at the June meeting, and she's helping us, she's supporting us through implementation. And through that, we're creating basically a workbook, and this is one page from the workbook that kind of reminds everyone what is co-requisite support. One of the things I keep hearing people say, and it kind of makes me cringe, is that we've eliminated remediation. We have not eliminated remediation. What we're doing is we're providing just-in-time support for students so that they can be placed immediately, enrolled and immediately in the college-level gateway course. But should they need support, that support would be available at the same time they take the college-level course. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And you'll see that that one-page sample document that will be included in the workbook that we provide to task force members does a nice job of kind of highlighting that. So with that, I would ask that you turn to page 3 of 5. I just want to walk the committee through what we've basically set up now in terms of our schedule. And what I should put on this is a big draft watermark as well, because this whole process is very organic. So a lot of this is etched out in stone in terms of the dates, but what's actually going to happen at individual meetings is constantly evolving as we have discussions with the various presenters, as we have discussions with our consultant and other groups that are supporting us through this work. So you'll see that immediately following the June board meeting, we contacted the presidents, and they appointed 3 members to the task force. So the task force includes a math faculty member, an English faculty member, and then someone from a supportive administrative area that will be what the institution considers a primary area of impact. So whether that's a registrar or an advisor or a counselor of some sort. So what we've tried to do with the task force is cover, you know, the key areas would be math and English, but then making sure that support areas are represented as well. I have asked the institutions to develop institutional task force, because it's very important that the institutions recognize that this implementation team is basically acting as a liaison between the system office and the consultants and accessing all the various support mechanisms that we'll have the opportunity to engage in through the implementation process. But they've got to take that back to the institutions, convey the message, communicate with all areas of the institution so that the institution can then ensure that they're aware of all those discussions, accessing that information, and making the decisions that they need to make so that they can achieve full-scale implementation by fall of 21. So with that, our first task force meeting will include just the task force team members, so those 3 team members from each institution, and we're set for September 26th. It is a jam-packed agenda. We are basically going from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. We're bringing in the STEM Core Initiative, which is a group in California that basically have created co-rec pathways for the students that are kind of, I call them the big elephant in the room, and that's those students that place below high school level but are on a STEM pathway. You'll know that that was an issue that we've grappled with initially, and some of the consternation from some of the institutions was, wait a second, we're not sure that this co-rec thing is going to work for that particular population. Well, California has made it work, and they've made it work through this STEM initiative that includes paid internship opportunities and a number of innovative resources that they have put into place. So we have an opportunity to kick off our meeting on the 26th and basically talk about the big elephant in the room and figure out, see if there are things that we can leverage that the state of California has done. We will spend the remainder of that day basically working through the workbook that the consultant has created and grappling with one of our big issues, which is will we do, and we will be asking the task force to make this decision, of whether or not we present to the board institution-level action plans or sector-level action plans. If it's a sector-level action plan, that means that the institutions within the same sector, so the community colleges, would all basically present together. We believe that creates an opportunity for there to be more synergy across the institutions, but it's also not a decision that I am comfortable at making and kind of pushing down onto the institution. So I want to hear from the task force what path they want to go on. So we're really empowering the task force to be involved in decisions that historically we might have just said, okay, you know what, the system office is going to make this decision. So I think it gives us a chance to have more of an organic conversation so that the task force truly feels in control. One of the other key outcomes from the September meeting will be an opportunity for the task force members to tell us what support they want. We've spent a lot of time over the summer bringing a lot of resources together and scheduling those resources for the various meetings, but I haven't had an opportunity to ask the task force members, what are we missing? What's on your mind? What are you concerned about? So that we can try to find support and bring that into a future meeting. In October, we will also, so that's the September meeting, we have a site visit at Citrus College scheduled for, it says October site visit, it's actually September 30th. Citrus College is located in Glendora, California, in the LA area. Again, another great example of an institution that hit the ground running with co-requisite remediation. So we're going to have the opportunity to bring in our math and English faculty. We're limited in terms of the size here because this is being supported by the California Acceleration Project that's going to help us with the November meeting. But basically, they're creating like a full workshop for us. So at the system level, we're paying their registration fees. The individual institutions will pay for travel. But what it means is that math and English faculty from the institutions will spend the day at Citrus College. They're going to get to go into the classroom. They're going to get to sit down with faculty who have already developed that curriculum. And basically, it's an opportunity to pick their brain and find out what worked for them, what didn't work for them, what can we learn from an institution that already has this in place. Because it turns out that full-scale co-rec implementation is not impossible, but it does have its fair share of challenges. So we want to make sure that we have an opportunity to talk to those folks who have been more than successful in doing that. Following the October site visit meeting, we will have a November 21st day together where we're expanding it beyond the task force members. So it'll include all the task force members, plus they can bring additional math faculty, additional English faculty, and we want them especially to bring in additional support administrators. So make sure they have an advisor there, make sure they have registrars there. And the purpose of that is in the afternoon, we will have a three-hour breakout session, one for math, one for English, one for advising, and one for administrators in general. And what we've done is we've accessed experts from across the nation where we're giving them a concentrated period of time with the individuals on the institution. And they've developed, and many of these individuals have done these types of workshops in other settings. So for example, for mathematics, it'll be the Charles A. Austin Dana Center at Austin University in Texas. They've done this work all over the country, and so they have, and it's not actually even a canned presentation. We've spent a lot of time on the phone with them saying, these are areas that we think are going to be challenging for our math faculty, and so they're catering a workshop around where we're at, because we already have some institutions that are there. UNR is there. UNLV is running two pilot programs right now, so we want to be able to share with them what we've done already so that they can look at that and provide us feedback. So part of what's going to happen before the November meeting is we'll basically have the institutions kind of fill out like a survey analysis type thing so that the Dana Center becomes very familiar with what's happening on each campus so that they can react to that in more productive conversations with the institutions. The initial draft of the action plans, whether they choose to be institution level or sector level, are due the office in March. The reason we're having, and that seems pretty early, but we want to have the opportunity for the consultant to review those so that we can have basically conference calls with the institutions and give them feedback, because we're in the process now of developing detailed guidelines for what has to be included in the action plan, because as regents, we want you to be able to look at these action plans holistically and say, okay, in terms of a communication strategy, this is what the community colleges are doing. But you know what? UNR is in a different place. This is what UNR is doing. So there will be some comparability across these action plans. But that means that the decision that the task force makes in September as to whether or not this is an institution-level action plan or a sector-level action plan will dictate revisions to those action plan guidelines. But we'll spend a great deal of time in November prior to the workshop sessions of going over with the institutions the expectations for the action plans. They will submit them in March. They will revise them accordingly. And then we will begin presenting to the board as early as June if they elect institution-level action plans. If they do sector-level action plans, we can do two presentations in September, so they actually get a little bit of time. That way, by September of 2020, the action plans will be in place and adopted by this board. That gives the institutions the following academic year, fall 20 and spring 21, to essentially hire any faculty that they need, make changes in PeopleSoft, do whatever they need to do to make sure that by the time fall 21 is reached, that they are able to have full-scale implementation of co-requisite math and English. So that's basically the schedule in a nutshell. We will bring you back a report in November that details what was achieved in September, what changes we made. As I said, this is an organic process. But now I'd like to turn it over to research scholar Theo Meek, and he's going to talk specifically about what's happening at the institutions now.
Absolutely. I just want to add two items on what Crystal was mentioning. In the September meeting as well, each institution will receive institution-level data of about 144 different data points that really break out by race, ethnicity, age, Pell status, gender, really looking at where the equity gaps are in both accessing and being successful in the current math and English pathways. And those will be broken down by both math and English. So, and then in addition, we've also received a lot of support for our November meeting. We've been working with Strong Start to Finish, which is a product of the Education Commission from the States, who is sponsoring Melinda Karp with Phase 2 Advisory to come in and work with our advisors. Melinda comes from the Community College Research Center at the Teachers College in Columbia, where she spent over 20 years, and then as a practitioner. So she'll be coming in and working with our advising teams to tackle this as well. So we're incredibly excited about that. I do want to share, also very excitingly, some of the work that's being done at the campuses and the institutions right now piloting co-requisite courses. So at UNLV, UNLV is piloting six sections of co-requisite that cover the three gateway math courses that they have, Math 120, College Fundamentals, Math 124, College Algebra, which is more specifically for business majors and a few others, and then 126, which is their STEM preparation pathway for pre-calculus. UNLV has set up the perfect experimental design in which the math department is piloting three sections, one of each of those that I just described, and the math learning center is piloting three sections of the same as well. So both moving forward with slightly different approaches to co-requisite support. They're going to compare success results to see if the math department did it better or if the math learning center did it better, and then they're going to move forward with that. So incredibly excited to see what they're going to come up with. CSN also began scaling up their co-requisite offerings. They have scaled up sections in all three of the courses that I listed above, 120, 124, and 126. And those have, again, started. Students are in those classes right now. And I just, after we submitted this report, heard from TMCC as well. TMCC is piloting English co-requisite courses, really the first in the system to scale up co-requisite English offerings. They are offering a five-credit English co-requisite course which is incredibly exciting. They have outlined really quite wonderfully the data points in which they're going to evaluate the success after the first semester under the leadership of Cheryl Cardoza. And I also want to add that and thank Vice Presidents Martin and Mergolo for specifically for very strongly supporting their faculty to attend a conference in July. In late June, we were able to make contact with the California Acceleration Project, as Crystal said, which is an organization that came from very organically from the passage of AB 705 in California, which mandated co-requisite reform. And they, the California Acceleration Project has begun holding a series of conferences throughout the summer to help their faculty do exactly what we're doing right now, both in Southern California and Northern California. At the point that we had heard about it, the conference was about 3 weeks away, and the California Acceleration Project very graciously opened up additional seats for us. Those two vice presidents in particular each sent four, very quickly mobilized and sent four of their staff members over to the conference. We also had representation from Nevada State College and UNLV, which was exceptional. We've heard nothing but great things about the faculty who returned from that and very clearly outlined, began to outline some of the charges and some of the needs that they're going to need in order to be successful in this. So those are the updates that I have. It's been a busy summer, and I am incredibly excited to see how these pilots are going to go at the conclusion of the fall semester.
Do we have any questions? It doesn't appear so. Thank you
for
the presentation. Thank you, Regent Carter. Okay, Vice Chancellor.
For the record, my name is Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. I would bring the committee's attention to a briefing paper policy proposal, and then we've also included a copy of the bill for legislation that was enacted during the 2019 session impacting the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship Program. So if you could please turn to page 3 of 6. And I'll start by providing a little bit of history. A couple years ago, the Chancellor created a task force of essentially the financial aid directors and myself, and he charged that group with looking at the state-supported financial aid programs. So that included the Millennium, the Promise Program, and the Silver State Opportunity Grant. Through those discussions, there were several recommendations made by the financial aid directors. One of them obviously has accumulated into the passage of this legislation and the presentation of this policy proposal concerning the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship. The way the scholarship works now for the purpose of continuing eligibility, state law is very specific in saying that for your first year of enrollment, you have to achieve a 2.6 GPA, and then thereafter, it's a 2.75. That creates, as you can imagine, some communication challenges with students. So what was recommended was that the higher bar is more appropriate because this is a merit-based program and that we have one GPA for continuing eligibility for your entire college career. So essentially, if you look at subsection 19 or 9, subsection 14B, you'll see we've made a technical revision there by eliminating some very old language that referenced the original 2.0 GPA for the class of 2003 through that earlier class through 2006. Then it basically eliminates the tiered 2.6 to 2.75 so that it's just a flat GPA for continuing eligibility. Again, not initial eligibility, which is based on your high school GPA, but continuing eligibility for that GPA that you must have in college to maintain eligibility for the purpose of the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship. This recommendation was originally presented to the AB 202 committee, which was a study committee that did its work prior to in the 18-19 interim. They recommended the bill, which ultimately resulted, again, in the passage of Senate Bill 453 that is also included in your reference material, and you'll see there the amendatory changes to SB, to that particular section of state law, are very straightforward. So with that, I would beg the committee's recommendation for approval and answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions? All right, I would entertain.
We're good here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So moved.
All right. Thank you, Regent Lieberman. Do I have a second? Regent Perkins, thank you. All those in favor say aye.
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 And I vote aye as well. Thank you, Crystal.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, I bring with you another piece of legislation enacted during the 2019 session concerning a waiver for certain veterans. So on page 4 of 7, you'll see there's a copy of the bill. And you'll notice if you actually compare the language in the bill to the policy proposal, they're aligned very closely, except for the areas where we have the authority for interpretation, where the state did not provide a definition. And I'll talk about that specifically in a moment. Essentially, the legislature enacted Assembly Bill 427, which provides for a waiver for veteran recipients of the Purple Heart. Obviously, the Purple Heart is a very distinguished honor for many veterans. And what this provides is, for lack of a better term, a last dollar waiver, so that if a veteran who has the Purple Heart received a Pell Grant or received other veterans' benefits, whatever is left over in terms of the registration fee, laboratory fees, or other mandatory fees are then waived or absorbed by the institution. So that's kind of a key distinction there. There are a number of waivers that are on the books, either in the board handbook or in state law. A waiver means that the institution does not collect the revenue. They forego that revenue versus a grant and aid. There are other grant and aid provisions. Grant and aid has a pool of funding behind it so that the institution does not absorb that cost. In this particular case, what makes this unique relative to existing fee waivers, so for example, the National Guard fee waiver is not a last dollar approach. You simply waive those fees. Again, after you fill out the FAFSA, provide your certificate of eligibility for the Veterans Administration and your Veterans Administration vocational rehab and employment benefits, whatever's left over would then be waived. There are two actual distinct differences between this and other waivers. So, for example, the National Guard fee waiver is limited to undergraduate programs that are state-supported. This is much broader if you look at subsection 2, and again, this is language directly from the bill. This applies to certificate, associate, bachelor's, master's, or professional degree programs. So where the National Guard fee waiver was narrow, this opens the door considerably to include professional degree programs. It also means by this language self-supporting programs, where the National Guard was very specific in it being state-supported programs only. So this is a considerable opening of the door. However, where they've narrowed it, obviously, is the fact that it's for Purple Heart recipients only, which, because of the nature of that award, we were unable to provide an initial fiscal impact, but we assume that, we don't know what it's going to look like in terms of numbers. One of the challenges with this bill, in addition, is that for the National Guard fee waiver, you've got to be a member of the Nevada National Guard. This particular provision for veterans that have received the Purple Heart is regardless of residency status. So you'll notice there is specific language in here that deems those individuals residents for tuition purposes. So that means you could be a resident of Utah or California or wherever and receive this benefit because we will deem you a resident for tuition purposes. The other area where this differs from existing waivers is that the National Guard fee waiver is for registration fees and laboratory fees, again, very specific to the statute and specific to the handbook. This goes a step further in including what they described as other mandatory fees. Unfortunately, if you look at the provisions of Assembly Bill 427, they did not provide a definition of other mandatory fees. So the board has that authority to make that interpretation, and you'll see in subsection 6, we've included the definition for other mandatory fees to essentially be those that are defined in the handbook. So student fees, special course fees, and differential program fees as they appear in that particular chapter, which is chapter 17. So that means those all have their own inherent definitions in that chapter. And therefore, again, it is a broader waiver than the current National Guard fee waiver. I think that's it. So with that, I would ask if the committee has any questions and beg your recommendation for approval.
Are there any questions? Chair? Yes, Regent Perkins.
I was wondering, how many credits does this cover? Is it to a degree program, or is there a limit on how many credits that are actually covered by this?
In the bill and in the handbook, you'll see there's no specific limitation on the credits. However, it only applies when the student is enrolling in a program leading to a certificate, associate, bachelor's, master's, or professional degree program. So essentially, it limits it that way, so that if you're in a bachelor's program, it's how many credits are required for that. It won't go beyond the requirements for that bachelor's program. So there is a limitation there.
Thank you very much. And if there's no further questions, I would move for approval.
All right.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Any questions? Other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 And I vote aye as well. And very pleased to do that. Thank you. Okay, we will move to item number 14, new business. Do any of the regents have a request for new business we should consider?
None here in Las Vegas.
All right, thank you. And item number 15, public comment. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas or here?
No comment in Las Vegas.
All right. The meeting is adjourned.